You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, on a very cold day in Washington. And thank you for joining us. My name is Marwan Muasher. I'm Vice President for Studies here at the Carnegie Endowment. We're very honored to have with us this morning the Right Honorable Alan Duncan, United Kingdom Minister of State for International Development. The minister is here to discuss the challenges of bringing security and development to fragile states, and in particular, his government's vision to bring stability and prosperity to Yemen. But before I begin, let me just say a few brief words about the minister and the extraordinarily fine work that he and DFID are doing today. Minister Duncan is without a doubt a man of the world. Growing up, he and his family traveled extensively during his father's time in the Royal Air Force. After studying at Oxford and Harvard, how can you top that? He worked as a crude oil trader, dealing regularly with the Middle East, South Asia, and Singapore, where he lived for 2 years. When he returned home, he won a seat in Parliament in 1992 and has been re-elected another 4 times since then. He has held numerous posts in the shadow government and today serves as Minister of State for International Development. In his current post, Minister Duncan oversees the Department for International Development, known as DFID, one of the world's premier development agencies. Even in this time of austerity, DFID continues to provide billions of pounds of development aid per year to the world's developing countries, immeasurably improving the lives of the least among us. Minister Duncan and his organization have also been enormously supportive of Carnegie's work on the Middle East, and for that, we are deeply grateful. One of the leading questions that DFID and the world's other leading development agencies must grapple with daily is how best to bring stability to fragile states, those corners of the world that are home to what Paul Collier has called the bottom billion. States mired in poverty, torn by war, and often unable to meet their citizens' most basic needs. Minister Duncan and his government are deeply engaged in this challenge, particularly in Yemen, and I'm delighted to welcome him to share his thoughts today. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Minister of State Alan Duncan.
Well, Bawad, thank you very much for that warm introduction. Henry Kissinger, I'm told, was once introduced with the words, "This is a man who needs no introduction," to which he said, "You're quite right, I need no introduction, but no one enjoys one more than I do." I thank you for your warm words, and my thanks to all of you for braving the cold to be here this morning. And can I begin by saying what a genuine pleasure it is to speak here at the Carnegie Endowment. It's a body that has done so much to push the boundaries of contemporary thinking on international foreign policy. And I'd like to acknowledge in particular the recent publications Yemen on the Brink, which is a typically insightful and thought-provoking contribution that stimulated much discussion amongst politicians and policymakers in the UK. In fact, I'm delighted to say that DFID helped fund the research, so it does prove that as a department we are successful in getting value for money. The value of your work is immeasurable. The more we share ideas on the big defining challenges of our time, be they Yemen or Somalia or Afghanistan or Pakistan, the greater our chances of finding workable solutions. So in that same spirit of collaboration, I want today to offer my own contribution to that debate by arguing strongly that any meaningful and lasting response to conflict abroad must have development outcomes at its very heart. In pursuing that argument, I want to examine the basic principles underpinning the link between development and conflict. I want to explore how conflict threatens a country's ability to pull itself out of poverty. I want to explain how instability can threaten our national security and I want to take Yemen as a specific example. I want to set out very clearly the United Kingdom's position on Yemen. And finally, I want to argue that we've got a pressing need to get this right, for which the Friends of Yemen process is key, and for which strong leadership is absolutely essential. Now, before I map out the link between conflict and development, let me pause for a moment to acknowledge that there are those, both here in the States and also back home in the UK, who argue that in times of economic difficulty, our aid budgets should be sacrificed. We say no to that. Although charity begins at home, it doesn't end at home. And what's more, there are broader interests which are served by our aid budget. Disease, trade, migration, the economy, climate change, all these things are directly affected by what happens overseas. Far from being a misuse of money, development is actually one of the most cost-effective and productive of policies. And that's why the UK coalition government stands by its commitment to devote 0.7% of gross national income to development from 2013. And I'm enormously proud of our Chancellor of the Exchequer and our Prime Minister for their steadfast leadership, and I hope that Congress can be equally courageous when it debates the issue next year. And nowhere is the value of development more apparent than in fragile countries. Now, these countries are usually already desperately poor, so as such, they lack the capacity to withstand the additional trauma of war. The UK government has reassessed the way we approach fragility and conflict overseas, establishing a new National Security Council, which brings together as one the Foreign Office, the Ministry of Defence, DFID, and all aspects of domestic security. So in future, we will look at security in the round, not in compartmentalised boxes that treat development, diplomacy and defence as standalone efforts. We believe that by taking a more integrated approach, we can actually better prevent conflicts from starting and reduce the risk of them escalating. Now, that's why we've doubled our aid for fragile countries. Our support has already helped to get more than 5 million children into school in Afghanistan and to make better healthcare available to 85% of the population there. But may I say, too, how much we welcomed the new US global development policy announced by President Obama at the MDG summit in September, and the acknowledgement that development is not only a moral obligation, but also a strategic and economic imperative within the US national security strategy. Now, like most of you here today, we also look forward to the launch of Secretary Clinton's Diplomacy and Development Review. With its emphasis on the contribution made by civilian power and an increased focus on peace building and conflict prevention, we expect to see much that echoes our own thinking. As I said earlier, development is an important part of the solution, but it's only one part. If we want to be successful in tackling conflict and tackling vulnerability and grievances, development must sit within a broader approach. By working together across government, we can enrich the effect of our efforts. But let me be absolutely clear on one thing. This is not a case of diverting development funding to meet others' objectives. This is not about the militarization of aid. Our aid will stick to development principles and to the OECD Development Assistance Committee definition of what constitutes aid. Now, just as there's a strong global interest in supporting fragile states, so too is there a compelling moral argument. No fragile state has yet achieved a single Millennium Development Goal. 22 of the 34 countries furthest from reaching those goals are in the midst of or emerging from conflict. Fragile states account for a third of those living in extreme poverty, for half of all children who are not in primary school, and for half of the children who die before reaching their fifth birthday. Paul Collier, the renowned professor of economics at Oxford, hit the nail on the head when he described war as development in reverse. The real dilemma is this. The only sustainable route out of poverty is through long-term economic growth. Yet fragile states, by their very nature,
find it hard to grow. Instead, they become drawn into a cycle of grievance and conflict. A typical post-conflict country with no economic growth, for example, faces a massive risk of returning to conflict within the 10 years following. In short, people living in conflict-affected countries bear a triple burden. They're poor, they live in fear of their lives, and the solution of long-term economic growth is beyond their reach. Now, I've talked so far about the various imperatives for addressing conflict, but I've said little about the issue that has most resonance with ordinary people in the Western world, security. So let me move from the general to the specific, using Yemen, a country which is very close to my heart, as a topical example. We have in Yemen a perfect illustration of the complexity of today's conflicts. We see individual and community grievances interacting with powerful regional and global factors. And as a result, tribal clashes become increasingly more difficult to manage. From a development perspective, Yemen's account is in the red. It has not and will not meet any of the MDGs. It has the worst figures of any country for the position of women in society. Its population growth is one of the highest. Food security and malnutrition are on the rise, and its macroeconomy has been failing, hitting a budget deficit of over $2 billion at the end of last year. And there's also the humanitarian problem of Yemen's 300,000 internally displaced people. Now, against this backdrop, violent extremism is flourishing, threatening both the world's security and even its energy supplies. But terrorism also represents a threat to the government of Yemen and to its people and to the development agencies and diplomats who are trying so hard to support the country. Clearly, then, the Yemeni authorities need and deserve our support in their efforts to tackle this challenge. But we must not base our reaction solely on the terrorist threat. Rather, our approach must be as deeply rooted in development as it is in defence and diplomacy. And it's this basic philosophy that underpins the United Kingdom's position on Yemen, a philosophy that sees that it's better to take action today rather than run the risk of state failure tomorrow. In Yemen, the UK has been historically involved, but we are now living in a non-imperial world. The UK has long since relinquished any wish to be some sort of bossy colonial force. All we wish to do is use our influence and aid to assist the security of the world and to improve matters for Yemen and all Yemenis. Now, today, the UK's position on Yemen amply demonstrates that we have not only learnt the lessons of history, but that we are prepared to invest time, effort, and money in making development a powerful force for good. Strong political will on the part of the government of Yemen is essential. And the Friends of Yemen process, which I want to come to in a second, is also key. We have to make sure that the process reinforces the triple agenda of development, defence and security, and that it does so in an integrated way. And that's why we're spending some of our resources in helping Yemen to build the capacity of its government and to strengthen its accountability. For example, we're working with the government, civil society and the tribal systems to encourage approaches which find local responses that are appropriate to local needs. And done well, this can mean that the same government can deliver tangible improvements in the provision of basic services for the poor, helping to address the concerns and grievances that, left unchecked, can fuel radicalization. Take, for example, our work on security. DFID support to policing and justice systems not only counters external threats, but it makes life safer for ordinary Yemenis. On the one hand, it brings improvements in community policing, and on the other, it makes it easier for the police to gather intelligence on the ground. This impact is magnified thanks to the support which the Ministry of Defence gives to the Yemeni Coast Guard and which the Foreign and Commonwealth Office provides on the wider political and human rights dialogue. In parallel with this, we'll continue with what you might think of as the more traditional development interventions, building schools and clinics and all the other things that Yemen's Social Fund for Development does so well. Since 2005, UK aid has helped to build nearly 150 schools and almost 2,000 classrooms. Thanks to the Social Fund, some 7 million or so people across Yemen's 333 districts have better local services. Within the next few years, it will have provided 10 million days of employment for Yemen's poorest people. But we need to look further to tackle the lack of jobs and the causes of child malnutrition. We need to support a process of national dialogue that will lead to inclusive and fair elections next year. And we need to get government working in a way that is more responsive to people's needs. Now, these are the foundations of lasting growth and the best defence against poverty and extremism. By working with civil society, local government, and the traditional tribal systems, we hope to address local grievances and to empower the government, and as a consequence, to see the emergence of a stronger, more stable Yemen. And may I say now that the UK calls on all parties involved in the Houthi conflict in the north to agree and implement a long-term peace agreement and to ensure full humanitarian access to all conflict-affected regions. In all of this, we have to be conscious of a bigger philosophical truth. Just as we choose to speak different languages, we choose to have different ideas of nationhood. We cannot look at Yemen and its concept as a nation simply through Western eyes. Arabic and tribal loyalties make up a different picture. And one of the biggest challenges facing us, therefore, is to resist the temptation to impose Western models on Yemen or to try to tell it what to do. Instead, we must give its government and its people the freedom to shape their own future. Now, the Friends of Yemen process recognizes that truth and provides us with a huge opportunity to support Yemen in its quest for peace and stability. And this brings me to the final point that I want to make today, that it is vital that the Friends of Yemen pull together and show commitment at this critical time. Too often in the past, our efforts have been fragmented. In truth, international support has sometimes been more of a hindrance to Yemen than a help. The Friends process finally offers us a way of coordinating our responses, but it won't happen on its own. We have to talk to each other, to be honest with our Yemeni friends, to be flexible, above all, to make sure that we have people in there, on the ground, in Sana'a, and that we listen to them. If we let this golden opportunity slip through our fingers, we and Yemen will pay the price for years to come. So as we plan for the next Friends meeting in Riyadh, which we hope will be at the end of February, we must not forget that there is still a lot to be done in the intervening months. In particular, we need to see a unified, prioritised, and crucially, Yemeni-led development and reform plan that will allow international donors to decide where to channel their support. And we support the United States government in championing the launch of a multi-donor trust fund to support Yemen's development priorities. I hope this will also prove sufficient to mitigate against any short-term negative impact of the IMF program on the poorest in Yemen. Backed by the strong leadership displayed by President Saleh and by the government, these measures will help Yemen to adjust to the change of the next few years. And at the same time, the international community must do more to improve the quality of its support so that it is less fragmented and better coordinated. And this applies to the Gulf and Western donors, and also to multilaterals and NGOs. Now, we can take heart from the progress that's already been made. Within Yemen itself, we've seen the implementation of the IMF program. We've seen an agreement to a ceasefire with Houthi rebels in the north. And we've seen the launching of the vital process of national dialogue. The Friends of Yemen meeting in New York in September was widely regarded as another successful step in the right direction. But this progress must be maintained. It would be so easy for any of the gains we've made so far just to fall away. And for me, the dire situation only sharpens my resolve. I know others in Yemen share my feelings. And of course, it behoves all of us to recognize that the experience of Yemen's neighbors, notably Saudi Arabia and Oman, has long overtaken our own in this area. We value their support and we'll continue to work with them. Ladies and gentlemen, I've focused this morning on Yemen, a country that I've known and loved, I would say, for many years. There are, of course, other countries that I could have mentioned. Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, to name but three. I would not suggest that what works for Yemen will necessarily work elsewhere. There are certain conditions that tend to make conflict more likely, hence our focus on prevention. But there is no template for what that conflict looks like when it happens. It is as unique as the individual countries it inhabits, and so too must be our response. For the UK, the one constant, the one certainty, is that any successful response will stand firmly on the tripod of defence, development, and diplomacy. What matters now is that all of us, the international community, donors, multilaterals, NGOs, governments, and civil society, galvanise our support for fragile states. In doing so, we can ameliorate the impact of existing conflict on the world's poorest people, and if we act quickly, pull others back from the brink. The will is there, and all that remains is to match rhetoric with reality. It was, after all, Andrew Carnegie himself who famously said, "As I grow older, I pay less attention to what men say. I just watch what they do." Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Duncan, for this very clear speech, for your support and work in Yemen, and for what I must say is a refreshingly holistic approach to development in general. We have about half an hour for questions, and in the interest of time, what I would like to do is take maybe, you know, a few questions at a time and allow the minister to respond this way. So, the gentleman over there, please.
My name is Yahya Fenoussi. I'm with USA for US-Africa Coalition. Thank you very much, Honorable Minister. Your tangential treatment of leadership and legitimacy will undermine all effort to get the fragile state to become responsive to the people. You need to focus on free and fair elections across the board. No compromise. Thank you.
Okay. Please, sir.
Daniel Morrow from SAIS University Center for Transatlantic Studies. The question is, at the end of your speech, in some way, if I well understood, you said that Yemen is different from other, say, failed countries. Can you explain a bit in what do you mean for different? Because, of course, we know Somalia and other countries which are...
Okay, yeah.
I'm Salim Ali. I'm a professor at the University of Vermont. Minister Duncan, I'm wondering if you could unpack this issue of development and conflict further. Because if you look at macro indicators of development, you'll find, in fact, that you could have development occurring and the potential for civil conflict within the country. And I think the intervening variable there is inequality. Because you could have development and growing inequality. Now, traditionally, economists have thought that as you develop, eventually inequality will go down. But recent experience has shown that doesn't happen. So I'm wondering, what is DFID doing to deal with this conundrum of inequality as you develop?
Okay.
Well, thank you. There are three very searching questions. The first is principled and absolutist, if I can describe it as such, and I quite understand why it is. Of course, in any country, we'd like free and fair elections just like that. It isn't always easy. You cannot just march in, demand them, and hope that then everything will be perfect. The world is a more complicated place. But as an objective, along with human rights, which we champion too, the question that was put was, in principle, 100% right. Yemen is different. I'm not saying it alone is different from everything else and all the others are the same. My point is that every country is different and that every country has to be understood individually and programs and approaches in diplomacy, defense, and development tailor-made to the needs of that particular country. So what I'm saying is that every country has to be treated as a special case and that you can't just have uniform programs and approaches which can be just imposed or implanted on any country in the hope that one size fits all. The third question I'm less sympathetic to. It's a clever turn of phrase that, yes, you might have development and conflict, but just to say that inequality is the key or the main driver is something I find, so far, unconvincing, but I may have to come to the University of Vermont for a quick tutorial. it's nearly up there with Oxford, I can tell you. It's not just equality. I think you've got to look at things like access to justice, grievance, the rights of women, gender equality, the basic provision of services, be they medical, educational, and simply homing in on inequality is, I would suggest, unduly simplistic and not as forceful a driver as the questioner suggests.
Well, since you trivialized Vermont, I might say that I did my PhD at MIT, and so I guess the next point I would go to Oxford.
It's closer to the better Cambridge. That's all right.
Different set of questions, please.
I'm Howard Wiarda from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS. Mr. Minister, I don't disagree with anything that you said in your presentation. It was very interesting and very well stated. Could you tell me a little bit about decision-making within the British agencies? That is, why Yemen, particularly when one could think of other fragile states that the British ought to focus on? And is there some division of labor, for example, between the French and the Brits and the Americans, with some responsible for Kenya and others for Somalia and maybe someone else for the Ivory Coast and you for Yemen? Tell us a little bit about the decision-making that goes into the British agency's decisions as to which countries to focus on.
Okay. Right. Please.
Ann Richard, International Rescue Committee. Mr. Minister, do you have Iraq within your portfolio? And if so, what do you make of its chances for recovery, and especially in light of the very large number of refugees and displaced people who are still unable to return home?
Okay. One more? Yes.
Hello, Minister Duncan. I'm Jed Kennedy from International Resource Group. And to piggyback off of a similar question that was asked, when I think about the situation in Yemen, I often would say that the degrading security environment and the low economic performance are actually results of poor governance rather than the causes of poor governance. And so I wanted to know if you would agree with that, and if so, what tangible role do you think that reform in the governance of Yemen could take place, or national reconciliation throughout the country? What role does that really play?
Yeah.
Very good questions. Let me first just address the Iraq question. I mean, we were elected 6 months ago, and I, to be absolutely honest, have caught the tail end of our efforts in Iraq, and it has significant oil reserves. It is effectively a middle-income country, so our strict poverty-focused development activity is diminishing. So the real answer to your question is no. That's not our principal focus or mine at the moment. The two questions on Yemen, I think, marry up interestingly. Firstly, on what is the decision-making process in our agencies, as it was put. Look, our focus on Yemen hasn't emerged in quite that way. First of all, we have a significant historical link. We also have significant historical links with the Arabian Gulf more generally, and in particular with its two main neighbors, Yemen's two main neighbors, Saudi Arabia and Oman. So it's natural that we should take an interest. And of course, as we've seen the last couple of years, really, there is a direct security threat to us originating from Yemen. And that doesn't half sharpen people's minds. And the question then is strategically, how do we handle that threat? Do we approach it hand in hand with development or as a separate exercise? And my thesis this morning is that we have to have it all joined up, and that development, diplomacy, and security all have to be treated as one. each can help the other. So that is the reason for our focus on Yemen, and I think it's absolutely the right thing to do. From my own personal point of view, having privately and initially commercially been going there for 20 years, I'm now in a political job where I know the players, I've known the president for 15 years, and so that gives us a particular link where many other countries have just completely neglected Yemen. It's a country of which they know very little and have paid little attention. So I hope this puts the United Kingdom in a position to have a significant influence over what happens there. And I would reiterate, it is influence, it's not instruction. We're not there to tell Yemen what to do. We are there as constructive friends, not as sort of colonial masters. And it's a very, very important point to make. The second question on Yemen was, is this all the result of poor governance? Well, to a large extent, yes. I mean, the country's been unified for 20 years. It had sort of communist activity in it in the many years before, ever since the Brits left Aden in 1967. It has not been easy to build a functioning nation. And there are questions about, you know, what is the nature of the nation state in southern Arabia? It's not difficult. It's not easy to make Yemen a really effective nation state. It's in its early days in many senses, with tribal underpinnings which don't convert naturally into the sort of nation state we take for granted in the West. And that is my point about having to understand the culture and the history of the country, and not just to judge it by our own standards and experience.
Okay. Lawrence Chandy, Brookings Institution, next door. My question is about DFID's its focus on fragile states. I think it's highly commendable that DFID is increasing the share of its aid to fragile states. I also think it's quite prescient. We're doing some research next door, which shows that the share of the world's poor who live in fragile states is rising very quickly. On our estimates, it's likely to exceed 50% by 2015. That's some research which we will publish next month. Now, if that's the case, then DFID is, you know, right on track in increasing its aid to those countries. However, we also know that aid to fragile states is more complex, more difficult, more risky, and perhaps more expensive to implement effectively. So given that DFID also has committed itself to reducing the amount of money it spends on administering its aid, I wonder if there is a tension there, whether DFID can simultaneously increase its aid to fragile states while reducing the share of its aid budget which goes on administration. And I'd like to hear the Minister's comments on that. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions, please.
Should I? Over there, yes. Hi, Robert Shalam from the Asian Development Bank. We don't work in Yemen, but very active in Afghanistan and Pakistan and a couple of others. In Afghanistan, for example, one of the things we're trying to do is to link this very landlocked, conflict-affected country with a healthy, beating economy, including that of China, Uzbekistan, and other ones. Can I just ask how you see the role of regional cooperation in the case of other fragile states? And linking, so you talked about local solutions as opposed to externally imposed ones, but what role should the, let's say, healthier neighbors of fragile states play in all of this? Thank you.
Okay. Should I do those two?
Yes, please.
Yeah. Okay.
The first question, I mean, easy escape route for a politician to say that's the wrong question. But forgive me if I try and explain why. You talk about our focus on fragile states and then ask about administration costs. I think actually the key question, if I can suggest it, is results. It's what comes out of the other end of the money you're putting in, of which administration costs are, of course, a component. We are determined to just shift the philosophy of aid to talking not about us spending, you know, $100 million or pounds somewhere and saying that's what we're doing, but saying we have a program in this country, and in return for $100 million, we're getting out the other end, 50,000 saved lives, so many people in schools. So this results focus is crucial. Now, if you're looking at the philosophy of aid, what are the pros and cons of this? Well, one of the obvious pros is that you're seeing exactly, you're counting lives and outcomes and effects. The danger is that it pushes you towards only doing what can be counted. And if you have what I call the jab in the jungle, you can count the number of children who are immunized and know how much, you know, per unit it costs. And you've got a really, really effective metric for looking at what money in produces in terms of a headcount coming out the other end. This is much more difficult in fragile states. And you're looking at, in some cases, a bit of a gamble. But one thing's for certain, if we can stop a state collapsing, we know that we are saving a massive multiple of the cost of stopping it, which you would otherwise have to spend if that state failed. You know, you might spend £1 billion in Yemen, but if it all goes pear-shaped, you're probably spending tens of billions. So the fragile state argument is not necessarily one that's easily measured, but it's something we have to do. And we are committed to spending 30% of our official aid budget on fragile states because we think the risk-reward ratio is compelling. So it's not just about the admin costs. It's not just about counting things that come out the other end. We are having to, if you like, as with any financial investment, to have a balanced portfolio. And that is where we've set the balance. So you're going to see a lot of the easily countable, you know, immunization, AIDS, TB, malaria, that kind of stuff. And you're going to see us on the other side of a balanced portfolio, a lot which is less countable, but as, if not more important, such as fragile states. So that I hope explains the philosophy of how we're choosing to apportion our budget. Regional cooperation, absolutely. You cannot just look at a country in an isolated way. I mean, all countries have neighbors. All countries are part of a global or a significant regional entity. And so in the case of Yemen, I mentioned the neighbors of Saudi Arabia and Oman. And of course, if you want a parallel, you just go across the water a bit and you're in Somalia. So yes, neighbors matter. And one of the issues of Yemen is whether we can entice some of its neighbors to move away from a direct, often unmeasured bilateral arrangement so that they become part of a more coordinated collective arrangement. And we think that in the case of Yemen, that would be very good. It's why we welcome the State Department, or the Treasury, actually, in the case of the US, championing a multi-donor trust fund, because this will bring the coordination we want to see in a way that overcomes, I think, something that is part of the problem, which is donor fragmentation. We ourselves are part of the problem of Yemen. And if we, who are donors, get our act together, we can help Yemen, the recipients, get their act together.
All right. Any more questions? Last one, over. Gentleman over there.
My name is Ali from Yemen Embassy. Thank you, Your Excellency, for your warm words about Yemen. In Yemen, the government said we have a serious problem in economy. And the opposition party said that the problem is the policy. So what's the, from your point of view, what's the main problem? Is it policies or the economy? Thank you.
Okay, one last question, yes. Well, I think with the gentleman over there, too.
Ann Richard again. You know, for the International Rescue Committee, we really welcome your and the UK government's approach on focusing on fragile states. I'm sure that the experts at the embassy here have already given you a heads up that that's not really the tenor of conversations right now with the U.S. Congress. And I noted your line when you were speaking about how you hoped the Congress would embrace the British approach, but our sense is that there's going to be a real push for fiscal austerity, and that when it comes to aid, it'll be very risk-averse and a push to invest in countries where they have good governments that can make the most of the funding. And so for my organization that works in fragile states, we're very glad that you're raising these issues. But in terms of your trip here, how do you anticipate getting any kind of traction for your ideas with the 112th Congress of the United States?
So let's take the last question over there and give the minister a chance.
I'm Rob O'Neill, and I'm a student at GMU at the Institute for Conflict Analysis and Resolution, also an employee of the Army Directed Studies Office. And I'd like you to talk more about the Houthi conflict, what role you see for development and resolving the conflict, and how you think we should best address the grievances of the Houthi family and their allies.
Okay. There's a sort of tentative ceasefire at the moment with the Houthis. That's what we want to see maintained. I think we need clear access to displaced people. And the Qataris are trying to mediate. I just hope the ceasefire holds and that the grievances, such as access to justice, can be secured. You know, I mean, I don't want to go into too much detail, if you'll forgive me, on such a specific issue. But it's fingers crossed that the ceasefire can hold, because if it breaks out again, there's a danger that it can be much worse than before. Let me... So from the Yemen embassy, is it the economy that's the problem or the policy? Look, it's all these things are mixed together. We want to see the government addressing the problems of the economy, and I think some very important steps have been taken, which are the introduction of an IMF plan. Now, the IMF plan is designed to reduce what was a growing deficit, and that is a policy on the economy, and it's a good one. Because if the deficit were to continue to grow and the currency were to crumble, food prices would go up and you end up with increased poverty. So I think the introduction of the IMF program is a very good step, but it's going to need more than just the introduction of an IMF program. I mean, we, for instance, as donors, are going to have to help mitigate some of the consequences of that, because if fuel subsidies are reduced, then some prices are going to go up and some of the poorest people are going to have to be helped with their fuel. So this is a very delicate path to rebalancing an economy in a way that is not going to disrupt the civilian population. So this is where we all have to work together and to look at it in the round. Aid, budgets, Congress. I think it's very important that we don't scoff at aid. Overseas aid or international development is very easy to mock. It's easy to mock by saying, oh, it all goes to corrupt dictators or finds its way in Swiss bank accounts and it props up the bad, doesn't help the good. And there are people who have argued in the past that it's all about poor people in rich countries giving money to rich people in poor countries. Well, I think that if there is a good philosophy of aid, and I would like to think that DFID is a leading force in this, it should be seen by all thinking people as a force for good. And it needs to be. We have been attacked quite a lot in the UK for ring-fencing our official aid budget and for committing to spend 0.7% after 2013, but I'm very proud we're doing it. But what I'd say, I think, to any politician in any other country is, please also take a look at what we're doing as well, which is that we're making sure that every penny spent is spent well. So we're reviewing every program we have bilaterally in every country we're working in. We are reviewing all of our relationships and spending with multilateral organizations such as the World Bank. And it hasn't half made them sit up and think and explain what they're all about. And it's been a very healthy process. So if things are balanced with a proper value for money agenda, and also, in our case, with a transparency agenda where we're setting up an independent watchdog, which can be as rude to us as they like, and they'll have full access to the facts, then I think you are politically in a much stronger position to justify aid. And, you know, at a time when, you know, bankers and politicians have made a mess of the global economy, our strong view is that we should not make the poorest people in the world suffer as a result.
and that we should keep going at this difficult time and commit to help the world's poorest and not rub their nose in the dirt just because we've got difficulties in the Western economy. And I'm very happy to stand up and take any political flack in defending that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister. I'm afraid this is all the time we have. Please join me in thanking Minister Duncan for a very rich discussion.